Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than MacReady when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Growing Up with Chapel Hill, The Village from 1901 to 1925, by Jane Toy Coolidge. About the author, Jane Toy Coolidge's reminiscences cover the first quarter of this century. The setting is Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and depicts the everyday life of town and gown in that period. Her father, Walter Dallam Toy, was professor of modern languages at the University of North Carolina. Her mother, Jenny Bingham Toy, was active in church and town affairs. This enabled Jane Toy to view Chapel Hill in an overall way. The author tells her story up to 1925 in this book. In that year, she married Charles Cal Coolidge, an attorney, and for 2 years lived in Laramie, Wyoming. From 1927 to 1975, she lived in Merchantville, New Jersey. All her mature life, she has been primarily a homemaker. She and Cal had 2 children. Her other interests have included the Merchantville Pennsauken Visiting Nurse Association, the American Association of University Women, and the Camden County Library. Mrs. Coolidge is both an author and playwright. She wrote Agatha in Carolina Folk Comedies, Mrs. Parker's Portrait, New Lamps for Old in Life at St. Mary's, and her latest book, Nils Larsen. She has many award-winning short stories to her credit. She now resides in Medford, New Jersey, and in addition to books, is interested in gardening, theater, bridge, and local history. This book was published in 1977. Continuing with Chapter 4, Dear Hearts and Gentle People. When Prohibition came in, Will McNider, who liked his toddy, took steps to assure a continuing supply for the family liquor closet. He knew that a fellow physician, Dr. Brack Lloyd, had a large country practice and was acquainted with all makers of moonshine in Orange and Durham counties. Brack, he approached him confidentially, you know my Aunt Eliza's a mighty delicate old lady. She needs a dose of medicinal alcohol every day, and there's nothing sets as well with her as pure corn liquor. Do you think you can get some for her?
Sure as shootin'.
Brack was more than agreeable. How much does Miss Liza need?
Well, said her dutiful nephew, I reckon 5 gallons would do for a start.
In earlier days, Dr. McNider had dated Miss Mildred Moses, who was to become Mrs. Lewis Graves. Of course, the word dated was not used then, but the activity it denotes remains pretty much the same. Village gossip took due note of this activity, and when the news broke that the doctor was engaged to be married, an elderly lady congratulated him.
Good for you, Will. I hear Miss Mildred has decided to have you after all.
For once, Dr. McNider was speechless. But the felicitations, though not mistakenly worded, were eminently well-deserved, for the doctor's marriage was destined to be a long and happy one. The bride was Miss Sally Ford, who, as Mrs. McNider, through the years was beloved by everyone in Chapel Hill. For many years, an outstanding figure in the university and the town was Professor Collier Cobb, head of the geology department, lecturer and world traveler. Rotund and pink-cheeked, Mr. Cobb was a dynamic character, enthralled with his chosen field of study and eager to introduce other people to its charms. This he did in lectures with what we called magic lantern pictures of such things as the shifting sands of Hatteras, and later on, as the scope of his travels increased, scenes as distant as the islands of Japan. He was an exuberant and entertaining speaker, a man of innovative ideas combined with good hard sense.
His proud boast was that he had edited a newspaper at the remarkably early age of 9 and made it a profitable enterprise. It was said that Mr. Cobb had performed an invaluable service to the town of Chapel Hill by marrying 3 wonderful women and bringing them here, and this was no idle statement. I knew only the 3rd Mrs. Cobb, the former Miss Mary Knox Gatlin, who had come in 1912 or thereabouts to take a very special place in the community. She made a happy home for her husband and his 3 children, William, or Billy, Collier Jr., and Mary, while becoming a leader in every worthwhile activity in the village. She was a pillar of the Episcopal Church, a wise counselor and helpful friend to 3 generations of Chapel Hillians. Mr. Cobb's practical sense was shown in his realization of the need for faculty housing when the university began its upsurge of growth, and his astuteness in acting to fill the need and to profit by doing so. He bought a hitherto neglected tract of land north of the post office and built there an attractive and convenient housing development, Cobb Terrace. This was a valuable addition to the town and a successful business venture for him, proving that professors don't have to be absent-minded denizens of ivory towers. Mr. Cobb's influence on the character of the community was a strong and lasting one. His son, Collier Jr., has been for 50 years a leader in every worthwhile activity in Chapel Hill, an eminently successful businessman, an astute and generous citizen, and a warm-hearted companion to 3 generations of Chapel Hillians. His wife, Emma Estes Cobb, is his partner in all these capacities, and their home on East Franklin Street is a center of happy hospitality. Professor Collier Cobb's daughter, Mary Louisa, was, until her death in 1976, so integral a part of Chapel Hill life that for many people she symbolized the heart of the community. Small of stature and modest by nature, she went her quiet way, performing with impeccable accuracy her duties as head of the Correspondence Bureau of the University's Extension Division, and, outside the office, lavished upon friends and neighbors never-ending acts of thoughtful kindness. Her fine mind had won her a Phi Beta Kappa key, and in all that she did, the high quality of her intellect was evident, but she never emphasized these gifts. Instead, she seemed to devote all her energies to helping other people, happy in their happiness, and forgetful of self. In Collier Cobb Jr. and Mary Cobb, Professor Collier Cobb gave to Chapel Hill a rich and enduring heritage. Today, such a woman would have many ways of making a living, but at that time there were only 2 obvious ones, school teaching and taking in boarders. The latter was the choice of most women in Mrs. Archer's situation. They knew all about running a house and managing servants. They were born to it and could do it well, holding their heads high and asking odds of nobody. Chapel Hill was an ideal spot for such a business, and through the years some of the town's most valued citizens have been women who ran boarding houses. Mrs. Archer was a strong character and a liberal one. When the village finally came to the point of building an adequate school, there was violent opposition to the bond issue on the part of penny-wise voters. Mr. Archer, by then an irascible old fellow, was one of these. When he announced his intention of voting against the bonds, Mrs. Archer made no comment, but hurried to the kitchen where her head waiter was at work. He was an able and trusted employee of long standing. "Tom," Mrs. Archer commanded him, "take off your apron and go downtown and vote for those school bonds. You see what I mean. Vote yes on your ballot." "Yes, ma'am." Tom looked at her and nodded gravely. "Yes, ma'am. I see. I'll do like you say." The bond issue passed. What was Mr. Archer like as a young man? Was he a gay blade, dashing and attractive? He must have had some charm, for he won the heart of the girl who was to be his wife. I can think of only one clue to the nature of this vanished youth, a comment he made when, as an old gentleman, he smiled appreciatively when a local belle walked by. His face lit up as he watched her every movement. "Yes," he said, "she's as pretty as a pair of red shoes." And once, when a privileged group of boarders sat talking in the parlor after supper, Mrs. Archer said something that was significant. The subject of the conversation was past decisions that had shaped the speakers' lives, and the question of whether the people who made the decisions would have acted differently if they had had a second chance. "As for me," Mrs. Archer said firmly, "I wouldn't change a thing." Before Mrs. Archer's time, and continuing for many years, Mrs. McNider's boarding house was one of the town's honored institutions. Where the post office now stands on the corner of Franklin and Henderson Streets was a dark, rambling house almost hidden by the trees and shrubs that seemed to have taken possession of the property. This was the McNider home, and here Mrs. McNider, a motherly widow, presided over a select household. Here she brought up and educated her two sons, one of whom was to become a distinguished doctor and teacher in the University Medical School. Dr. Will McNider was a highly skilled physician, and also a born wit. He held listeners spellbound with accounts of local happenings, some of them the kind usually kept quiet, and he told these tales in a backwoods accent that enhanced their charm. Students in the medical school relished this accent, and sometimes imitated it. Once, when the doctor was lecturing to a class, he suspected that the boys weren't paying attention, and stopped suddenly to throw out a question. "What is the effect of digitalis on the heart? Does it increase the action or decrease it? Increase or decrease?" Quick as a flash, Adam Thorpe spoke up. "Crease, doctor, crease." "Right, Thorpe," Dr. McNider said approvingly. "I see you were listening after all." A member of the McNider household was Mrs. McNider's sister, Miss Eliza Mallett. Always of small stature, Miss Eliza shrank to minuscule proportions as the years went by, and I remember her as a frail little lady who may have weighed 80 pounds. At least she looked frail. Actually, she had surprising stamina. When I was a little girl and walked from our house on West Franklin Street up towards the center of town, I would pass the home of Mrs. Harris King. This occupied a large lot across from the present University Square, and the lot was separated from the sidewalk by a long picket fence. This fence presented an irresistible temptation to passing youngsters, especially if they happened to be small boys. To hold a sturdy stick in your hand and run it along the pickets was a sport that never palled. The resulting noise was music to their ears, the sensation of mastery deeply satisfying. To this pleasure was added the extra spice of danger, the thrill of risking life and limb. For to the owner of the fence the sound of a stick on pickets was anything but pleasing. Whatever the time of day, and no matter how busy elsewhere on the premises, Mrs. King would dash out of the house to defy the criminals who were attacking her property. With fist-shakings, blood-curdling imprecations, and dire threats, including that of calling the police, the furious old lady scorched the offender's ears. And if she happened to be watering the grass nearby, she turned the hose on full strength to give them a soaking. I never incurred any of these penalties, for I was a law-abiding citizen, and timid by nature, but I witnessed many such performances and relished them with vicarious pleasure. Mrs. Harris King, as she was generally known, was a sister of General Julian Carr, the successful industrialist who, in post-war years, had built cotton mills in Durham and in Carrboro. Carrboro was called Venables until he came along. A generous supporter of the university, he contributed $500 in 1875 when funds were being scraped up to make possible the reopening of the institution, and later he made the far larger gift of the first modern dormitory, that is, one with running water, the Carr Building. His sister had been married twice, first to Mr. Harris, and after he died, to Mr. King. Apparently, the first marital venture was the more felicitous of the two, for she preferred to be called Mrs. Harris, or, failing that, Mrs. Harris King. Actually, she was usually referred to as Miss Lizzie King, a name that rolled with pleasure on the lips of adventurous small fry. Mrs. Harris's own children had long ago grown up to be respected citizens pursuing successful careers in their chosen fields. One daughter married Mr. Bob Eubanks, whose store was a well-known part of the town, and the Eubanks children, Margaret, Robert, and Lida, were my friends. Among the women who chose to make their homes in Chapel Hill was Miss Alice Jones. She had come at the turn of the century with her sister, Miss Mary Best Jones, later Mrs. Isaac Manning, to enroll in the university summer school. In the years that followed, she returned for frequent visits, and around 1913 stayed to embark on an ambitious project, the establishment of a small, select boarding school for girls. Miss Alice had been a professor at Winthrop College, and successful as a teacher in private schools in the North, where she had made friends with wealthy patrons, and had been led to believe that there was a need for such an institution in the milder climate of the South. Chapel Hill seemed the ideal location, and Miss Alice, being a woman of action, seized the opportunity. The school was opened with two small pupils accompanied by their grandmother, who was, I believe, the moving spirit behind the project and its angel. Miss Alice had rented the Hume House on West Franklin Street near the site of the present Granville Towers, had engaged one teacher, a cook, a maid, and a handyman, and gotten down to business. The teacher, Miss Margaret Strudwick, had a rich heritage of blue blood and was highly endowed with southern grace and charm. I think she was supposed to transmit the last two qualities to her charges by the process of osmosis, but she may have taught them French and dancing, too. Miss Alice instructed them in sterner and more practical subjects. The school flourished for a while. Miss Alice, Miss Strudwick, the elderly Mrs. Noyes and her granddaughters, Madeline and Betty Galt, entered into the social life of the town and were active in the Episcopal Church and Sunday School. The girls were about 10 and 12 years old, and, considering the fact that they came from a very different world, fitted in pretty well. Madeline, the elder, was inclined to be pugnacious, and sometimes threw her weight around, as on the occasion when she boasted to a group of youngsters, "My uncle married a title." Jimbo Bullitt, about the same age, and of similar temperament, took up the cudgel for democracy. "That's nothing. My great-grandfather discovered Kentucky." Encouraged by the school's successful beginning, Miss Alice bought property on West Franklin Street next door to my parents' home and remodeled the big old house that stood there. An impressive avenue bordered by tall trees led up from the street, and the house itself was commodious, if a bit dilapidated. When the extensive repairs had been completed, furnishings were sent down from New York, elegant and attractive things, including colorful chintzes and deep-piled rugs. The school was given a name, Contentnea, and a new session began. What happened next, I do not know, but one sad fact is clear. Miss Alice's brave venture came to naught. Obviously, Mrs. Noyes and her granddaughters couldn't stay on indefinitely, and no other wealthy patrons appeared to enjoy the southern paradise prepared for them. Contentnea closed its doors. The house was rented, first to the Cranmers, former residents of Chapel Hill, returning now that their son was ready for college. Sad to say, Jack Cranmer died in the fall of 1918 when he was a member of the Student Army Training Corps and fell victim to the Spanish influenza. After this, the house was occupied by a fraternity, and later Dr. and Mrs. Reese Berryhill bought the property and again remodeled it, removing 6 or 8 bedrooms and creating the charm Miss Alice had envisioned. Then, engulfed by the tide of progress, the place was sold and the house torn down to make room for the busy shopping area we know today. Undaunted by Contentnea's demise, Miss Alice had turned her back on the past and pressed ahead to new endeavors. For some years she continued her career as a teacher, serving briefly as Lady Principal of St. Mary's School, while that archaic title prevailed, and finally returned to Chapel Hill to embark on a second business venture. Happily, this one was to be a success. She bought a sizable tract of land behind Dr. and Mrs. Manning's home, and on it built one by one a number of houses and apartments for rent or sale. For some time she occupied one of these, and then, as the enterprise became a success and profits piled up, she bought more land across the street and built a dream home for herself. Here, in beautiful and comfortable surroundings created by her vision, acumen, and energy, this loyal Chapel Hillian spent her last years. To a child growing up in Chapel Hill in the early 1900s, it was obvious that the world belonged to white people. Colored people were a part of the everyday scene, but always in the background. They were treated considerately, often loved, but never taken very seriously. This attitude was prevalent among most adult whites, too, and seems to have been accepted by both races. There was no conflict between them, and no apparent awareness of racial problems. If black people had differing views on this score, they kept them quiet, pursuing the jobs open to them, and often performing them so well and with such dignity that they were highly respected members of the community. In times of trouble, they turned to their white friends for help, and this was given according to the paternalistic tradition of the South. By such personal, individualistic measures, white citizens tried to do their duty by their black neighbors. But some people realized that there was a need for more than this, and to fill this need made a concerted effort to enable the rising generation of Negroes to help themselves. The Orange County Training School was established for this purpose, and for years a group of public-spirited townsmen and professors worked to maintain the institution. Basic education and manual training, which would enable graduates to support themselves, were the school's objectives, and the men who served as trustees spent long hours struggling to implement these projects. There was little money to spend, and pitifully limited facilities. But under the leadership of Marcus Cicero Stevens Noble, the work was carried on successfully. Mr. Noble was a colorful character, his appearance as striking as his name, a florid, hawk-nosed face under a bushy crest of graying hair, a vigorous, stocky frame, and a dynamic manner. He was ahead of his time in the realization of racial problems and the need for more and better education for Negroes. Towards this end, he worked indefatigably, enlisting the help of other men and women who supported the cause, giving liberally of their time and energy. One of these men was my father, whose repeated attendance at these meetings was apt to last late into the night and take heavy toll of his strength. Throughout the South, hundreds of other men were doing the same thing, laboring step by small local step to help their black neighbors on the upward climb to a better way of life. In the light of today's more spectacular civil rights programs, these men are apt to be forgotten, but their work laid the foundation for progress that was to come. As a little girl, I knew colored people only as helpers who ministered to the family's daily needs. There was Abe Massey, heavy and slow of movement, who came at crack of day to shake down the ashes in the big wood-burning fireplace and pile on the logs to keep us warm. There was crusty Aunt Caroline in the kitchen, Stella Oldham, who came spring and fall to sit at the sewing machine in the upstairs hall making my gingham dresses, and Bill McDade, who had been my father's houseman when Walter Toy was a bachelor. Bill had beautiful manners, suave, courtly, and genial. His wife, Fanny, was quite light of skin and highly intelligent. They had a daughter, Viola, who became an expert seamstress, whose services were much sought after by the ladies of the town. She was attractive as well as able, and I remember hearing a friend of my mother's, a northern woman, refer to Viola as a lovely girl. This gave me a surprise and something of a shock. I would have expected her to say Viola was nice or capable or polite, but to say that she was lovely was to speak of her as an equal, and in the world I knew, this just wasn't done. I'm sorry to say that Viola, who richly deserved the lady's characterization, died at an early age. Her parents continued to live for many years in their house on West Cameron Avenue. Aunt Augusta Evans lived on West Rosemary Lane, about a half mile from our home, and sometimes did fine laundry and other jobs for my mother. When I was sent to take a message to her, I was fascinated by her house, so tiny that it was like a dollhouse, immaculately clean and neatly furnished. Unlike many colored people's houses in town, it was well painted inside and out, and on the parlor walls were several crayon portraits of white people. Aunt Augusta was almost white, with fine, clear-cut features and blue eyes. She was slight and wiry, a hard worker who bullied her daughter unmercifully. The daughter, Mary, was severely retarded, we said half-witted, but capable of doing routine tasks and carrying big baskets full of the clothes her mother washed and ironed. Sometimes these baskets were piled high with crisply starched organdy dresses, for when school friends were visiting me, my mother would send all our summer frocks to Aunt Augusta. And sometimes, probably on similar occasions, she would send her a batch of chickens to be killed, cleaned, and dressed. Once, when such a batch was returned, the livers were missing, and my mother asked Mary what had happened to them. "Oh, them chickens didn't have no livers," Mary replied. I wonder now, what was the story behind Aunt Augusta? That there was a story is obvious, but such things were not mentioned in our world. The Hargraves were one of the leading families of the colored community. Luther Hargraves was a skilled carpenter, and the father of a large family of children who grew up to take an active part in the life of the town. One of these, Fred, was the same age as my brother Walter, and when he was in his early teens, came regularly to work at our house. He and Walter became great friends, and perhaps because of their friendship, Fred stayed with us for 5 or 6 years, working in the house and yard always with courtesy and goodwill. Early every morning he came to build the fire in the kitchen stove, and he returned when school was over in the afternoon to do odd jobs, help with supper, and to study. In his crowded home there wasn't much chance for studying, so my mother arranged for him to stay on in the evening and do his homework in our kitchen. He graduated from high school, went on to college, and to a successful career, first in the offices of a Durham bank, and then in a similar position with a federal bureau in New York. The Hargraves were a musical family. Fred played by ear, pounding out ragtime on the old square piano in our parlor, to the enthusiastic applause of my brothers, myself, and our friends. Sometimes Fred's younger brother, Lillington, he was called Lilibet, would come too and contribute to the entertainment. I think Lilibet later worked for a fraternity, where his talent was probably very welcome. For many years I lost touch with Fred when we both had left town, but recently I had a pleasant surprise when he called me from New York, and we had a happy reunion over the phone. High standards of personal integrity and conscientious performance of duty have always prevailed among the leaders of Chapel Hill's black community. Through the years, many men and women have exemplified these qualities, and they're remembered with affection and respect. I think of Aunt Charlotte, who welcomed scores of village babies into the world and gave them and their mothers devoted care. Of Alice Neal, so expert a caterer that she could take complete charge of a huge reception at the president's house and serve delicacies as delectable as if they had been sent from Delmonico's. And Maggie Booth, who made dressmaking a fine art. On the campus, almost every building had a trusted custodian who took pride in his responsibility for the building and its occupants, and protected their interests with unflagging zeal. Long ago, a group of students paid a rare tribute to four of these men, erecting in the western part of the cemetery a tall granite shaft with this inscription: "Members of the class of 1891 place this stone in memory of Wilson Swain Caldwell, who lies here, November Caldwell, David Barham, Henry Smith, who served the university faithfully." In the years since the monument was put up, many more men and women have carried on the tradition made memorable by these four, contributing in no small measure to the well-being of the town that we love. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.